Good evening, everybody. I'm John Mitchinson. I am here this evening to chair an event which was originally billed as an edition of Backlisted, but can't be because Andy, my partner in crime, is unable to be here. But I'm hoping the spirit of warmth, erudition, kind of...
That's mainly you.
Deviation.
That's mainly you.
Yes, keeping yeah. well off the subject in hand. We'll persist through the next hour. We will, unlike the podcast, have time for questions from the audience afterwards. I've got two sponsors to thank. The Arts Council of England, thank you. The other sponsors, I suppose, the people out there in the ether, welcome to the live stream. We hope to entertain you. But let me start and introduce my two distinguished guests, neither of which I suspect will need massive amount of introduction, but I'll do it anyway. Natalie Haynes is a writer and broadcaster, and according to the Washington Post, a rock star mythologist. Yes.
Didn't even know it was a job.
That's brilliant. That's what we all want. Her retelling of the Trojan War, 1,000 Ships, relevant to tonight's discussion, was published in 2019, shortlisted for the Women's Prize for Fiction in 2020. Her most recent non-fiction book, Pandora's Jar, Women in the Greek Myth, was published by Picador in 2020 and has been, to be fair to say, rapturously received. From everybody from Margaret Atwood to Mark Haddon and many other places in between. It was also a top five bestseller in the US?
Number two on the New York Times. Oh!
for the camera, number two, yeah, number on two. The New York Times bestseller.
Yeah. Number two, so top two bestseller.
Yeah. It's annoying, isn't it? It's a book, it's called The Body Knows the Score, and it's a book about how trauma is depicted through... physical and psychological consequences. Anyway, it sounded exactly like the sort of book that would be in the charts for four and a half years, which it so far has been. Yeah.
Great. But you've got a new novel coming in September, Stoneblind,
yes.
Which is a reimaginative retelling of the story of Medusa.
Yes.
Something like that.
Yeah. She's a heartbreaker, though, I'm just warning you now.
Is she?
She is, actually. Yeah. Sorry, Peter, I know.
A gorgon.
Yeah.
Right.
I cried hard writing her, so yeah, everyone else is gonna.
We should also say you write for The Guardian, you're a regular contributor to Radio 4, notably as a team captain on three seasons of Wordaholics.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. And your six amazing stand-up shows, which I have now been listening to and loving. Natalie Haynes stands up for the classics. Available on BBC Sounds, not a sponsor this evening, but I should say if you haven't listened to them, they are brilliant.
I mean, they're an indirect sponsor because I would have starved to death long ago without the BBC.
Correct.
So the new series is out in August. I meant to tell you that before. Thanks. August 14th.
It's not long.
The last and slightly weird fact from your Wikipedia page, which always amuses me.
Is that where all this has come from? Because I was supposed to send her a biography and I forgot. I'm so sorry.
I love doing it. It's always nice when they don't. Because it says on your Wikipedia page, which I thought was really sweet, was that you're the only comedian to have appeared at every Newbury Comedy Festival.
Yeah, you know what? I have nothing to do with the Wikipedia page, obviously, so I've no idea if that's true or not.
The Newbury Comedy Festival, I put it to you, stopped in 2012, so it's kind of...
Yeah, I'm sure that's right. I mean, I stopped comedy in 2012.
Maybe that's why they stopped. They just felt that...
Once I was gone, what was the point?
It had become pointless.
Yeah. It tasted of ashes and wormwood after that, I think, someone said. So.
Anyway, you know. I would like for you all to give Natalie a round of applause for being here. We're going to have so much fun when we get to the book in hand, or books in hand. But
yeah,
I turn to my a friend, a colleague, an inspiration for many years, Peter Florence. I love this. A reader, writer, festival maker, tree planter, co-director of the European Festivals Forest. In 1987, he performed war music. This I didn't know, and it's very good to know this. He performed as a rhapsode at the Lyric Hammersmith and the Almeida, and then onto internationally for the British Council. You're a patron of this fine Ledbury Poetry Festival. And during lockdown, he binge-listened, of course, to Natalie Haynes's Stand Up for the Classics on repeat. How sweet. You didn't have to say that, but it's nice that you did.
No, I did, and I literally loved every second of it. Can't wait for August the 14th.
Thank you. They take ages, so I'm really glad. And also, when we made them, we didn't. Sorry, this is a bit of a sidebar. We didn't know that they would ever be on Sounds. It took 4 or 5 years to persuade them that it could go up there. And nobody had realised while we were making them that I was making them in sort of one big non-repeating arc, so they would be satisfying to listen to together, even though no one ever could. And then very gratifyingly put them on Sounds. People were like, oh, God.
Sounds. It's great. I should confess that the first time I met Natalie, I saw her. She was being a compere at something. I was so impressed by it. I went up to her and said, you know, that was so amazingly funny and witty. You should do it as stand-up. She said, I am a stand-up. I have been doing it for... So,
I mean, if the other work dries up, I would go back. Do you know? It's a tough life, but I would still go back.
Stand-up and classicism, though, it's all good. Anyway, the book that we're here to discuss today is War Music by Christopher Logue, which he began writing, Christopher Logue, English poet, who died in 2011. He started writing it in 1959, and we'll maybe talk a little bit about how that came about. And then it was published in various stages. The first... But it is, we should say, a loose... It's not a translation, it's a loose version of Homer's The Iliad. And it is... it was incomplete when he died and will remain, obviously, incomplete forever now. What I should say is that it was published... The original War Music was published in 1981, and that was books 16 to 19 of The Iliad. Then he had, in 2001, he added books 1 to 4, and then All Day Permanent Red came some years after that, books 5 to 6. Then in 2003, Cold Calls, his version of books 6, 7 to 9, and the Whitbread Prize for Poetry in 2005 for Cold Calls. Unfortunately, he fell ill, died in 2011, and it was only in 2015 that they brought the whole thing out in this one single volume with an appendix. With my favourite bit in all of Christopher Logue is his title for the projected final volume, which is Big Men Falling a Long Way, which was his kind of shorthand, witty shorthand for tragedy. Anyway, what since then, and maybe since 1981, it's been acclaimed as a kind of one of the great poetic achievements of the late 20th, early 21st century. All the usual suspects are there to call it a masterpiece. George Steiner called it a work of genius. Lewitt McNeice praised it as not a translation, but a remarkable achievement of empathy. And that reliable witness, Henry Miller, exclaimed, "I'm crazy about it. Haven't seen such poetry in ages." This is an attempt, I suppose, to unpack over the next hour what the poem is and why it is still very much worth reading. But we ought to start, I wanted to start with the question we normally start a backlisted with, which was to ask, maybe I'll start first with Natalie, because I'm going to change the format a little bit, because I know, Natalie, that you read this especially for this.
I did.
So the interesting question is really to ask you when you first encountered Homer, and particularly the Iliad.
Oh, young, because I was a big nerd. So I started Greek at 14.
Wow.
And then I did, I can't remember, the Odyssey 21, I think, was my GCSE set text, which is the stringing of the bow and the arrow through the axes. And then Iliad 6-7 were my A-level text, which is Hector going back to Troy and finding Andromache on the city walls, that really beautiful bit, which sort of foreshadows the action that we'll see in Euripides' Trojan Women. And then the duel between Hector and Ajax. So that's when I first read the Iliad. I guess I was probably 16, maybe 17, so really young. I mean, I blithely pointed out that it must be quite unusual to come that way round to this, because I would never have read modernist poetry by a man, if I am absolutely honest, as a teenage girl.
It's good. Get that out there.
A long since dead man was much more my kind of thing. In fact, I still often prefer a long since dead man, both in poetry and sometimes in general.
We will return to the Iliad and the charms of the Iliad, but that's Peter. this was your suggestion so you must have a, when did you first encounter Christopher Lowe?
I've also got a first Iliad moment, which is so, when I was maybe seven, I think I came third in the school French competition, and a prize day we had, for reasons that I cannot imagine, Douglas Bader. And for anybody in the audience who does know who Douglas Bader is, you get it. For anybody who doesn't, then I commend to you the Horrible Histories, The Few song. We had Douglas Bader, the greatest World War II ace, who came to present the prizes. And the prize he gave to everybody, even the person who came fifth in the French competition for year three, was this incredibly beautiful Paul Hamlin picture book of myths and legends, which had in it an Iliad story. Now, for those of us who don't have Greek, it was my first encounter with the narrative, or the bare bones of the narrative. And then I think I must have gone through Roger Lansing Green and whoever, and eventually I crashed into the, frankly, slightly difficult E.V. Rieu, which we were talking about, and I kind of read Latimer and Fagles and Fitzgerald. And if you don't have Greek, none of that is really quite satisfying enough. I can hear you going, well, just learn Greek then.
I mean, it is hard, Greek. Latin's all right, but Greek is hard. Yeah. It just is.
But I met Christopher Lowe because we were both appearing at the Cheltenham Festival. And I was doing a show about Wilfred Owen, which he came to see and said, I think you should come and see me. And I went to go to him, and he was doing a reading of war music with Alan Howard, who was a grand Shakespearean actor with a big voice. And Howard was sort of declaiming it and was fine, but slightly resistible. Whereas Christopher was so precise, so energised, had kind of got his own extraordinary inflections, but his own energy into every word. And he delivered it like a stand-up routine. And it made perfect sense. And from what we know, from what I know of what Natalie told me and Natalie Haynes stands up for classics, about how this was first generated, composed, how we get Homer, that seemed to me to be an authenticity stretched to a logical modern point.
I mean, there's something to be said, isn't there, for being authentic without being accurate, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
So it is undeniably the case that Homer is pre-writing or pre-alphabetic writing in terms of composition, and I would imagine that Lowe probably wrote. But it just doesn't matter. The act of composition and then constant editing and then re-editing and, you know, the very fact that it took decades and was unfinished actually makes him more Virgil than Homer in some ways, I guess. But it suggests that process.
Well, that's interesting as well, isn't it? Because the great thing that Logue has that whoever, whatever, Homer, and we'll come to that, I'm sure, doesn't, is he's also got... He's got Virgil, he's got Shakespeare, he's got Coleridge, Pound. You can read so much into this. And then he generates in really interesting ways. You know, without war music, I don't think Ted Hughes would have necessarily done his Ovid.
I love those. They are really good.
And Simon Armitage has gone into
Seamus Heaney, maybe
Walcott,
his Beowulf.
So there's a sort of engagement with the classics that I think he makes possible through this. But I was thinking, when you were talking about that beautiful moment of Hector and Andromache, there are sort of two moments in the Iliad that knock your heart out. One is that conversation between Hector and Andromache on the wall, and then there's the moment with Priam going to beg for Hector's body back from Achilles. Now, if those are the two, I say there are two, there are many, many moments, my heart out. But what's interesting about war music, which was originally books 16 to 19, which is the death of Patroclus and the agreement for Achilles to return to the fray, that in Horace's terms of in medias res, is that is the zooming in on the crux of the Iliad. Because, and again, I'm wading into your territory here.
No, you
but
go right ahead.
Although this is the song of Achilles, It's not called the Achilleid, it's called the Iliad. Ilium is all of the allies of Troy, but is also all the Greeks who are at Troy. It's like Gallipoli or Thermopylae. It just stands for all of it. But there's a the key change, the character change in the Iliad that you long for and that makes sense of what happens is the moment when Achilles becomes most human. And I think he becomes most human in grief and in his response to Patroclus. And then, you know, what's the irony of this is that generates the greatest inhumanity, a violence so complete that he takes on the river. And it's not enough that... we'll come back to the way Logue writes about violence. But it seems to me that those books have particular things that happen also in terms of plot. Like, one of Zeus's children dies.
Yes.
You know, Sarpedon dies. This is a very big deal. Up until book 16, and I know this is a bit much, but nobody you really care about dies. None of the major characters. It's not Game of Thrones. But suddenly, 16 to 19, you get Sarpedon and then Patroclus, who is, along with Andromache, the only character who is sort of loved internally. And he's loved by more than one person. Anyone who knows Patroclus really likes him. And the way I think Homer, from my readings of it, and certainly the way Logue portrays it, is his death is a wrench for all of us, not just
everybody,
for Achilles.
Yeah.
And you think, we've now passed the point of no return. And you don't really want to go and see Hector dying, because you know that's coming. And we know, because we've been to Hamlet. You know, when he says, Aeneas tailed to Dido and thereabout of it, the part where he speaks of Priam's slaughter, well, that's in Euripides and it's in Virgil. It's not in the bloody Iliad at all.
The Iliad is only 2 months. This is the bit that people always forget as a great war narrative, which
it
is.
Right at the end.
It's 2 months in the 10th year of a 10-year war.
Yeah. And within those 2 months, these 2 days are the days that really drill in.
Shall I put the writing of the poem in a bit of context? Because it starts with a commission from Douglas Carnes Ross, who was a classicist who was at that stage making programmes for the BBC. And he suggests to Logue that Logue would quite like Homer and suggests the Iliad. And he chooses the bit of Achilles fighting Scamander, the river god. And that goes quite well. And then he gets a bigger grant to do more. So he writes, I rather like this, he writes to Carnes Ross saying, what shall I do? He just gets this terse kind of message back. Iliad 16, the Practiclire. It's the Iliad in miniature. It begins with a quarrel, continues with a making up, then a human checking a god, and as a result of the human's punishment, death, an irreversible change that brings destruction to Troy. Good luck, Donald. And from there, it more or less takes over Logue's life, doesn't it? He kind of in and out of this poem for the rest of his life.
Well, it's odd. I mean, in literary terms, yes, but at the same time, and this is why Logue's interesting, he also, let's say, edits, but I think also writes, the true stories in Private Eye every fortnight.
Yeah. He edits Sood's Corner.
And he has an incredibly successful career as a playwright. He also writes some of the most powerful political poetry of the 60s and 70s. He's the standout star with Adrian Mitchell of all Michael Horowitz's great poetry and Olympiads and things. So, yes, whilst this is his
big
thrumming...
Big CND man.
Yeah. This is the drone that works throughout his life and says this. But it, as Natalie says, I mean, it does, doesn't it? Homer, and in your case, Euripides, get you and you're just locked in because what else would you want to do?
And you can't tell who it's going to be either. I've had I've had Ovid's Metamorphoses on my desk for 5 years and it never makes it back onto the shelf because obviously we have unfinished business. And it's that thing where it's like, oh, okay, I don't even know what it is yet, but I'm not fighting this book, it's too big.
There are weird things in this, which I want to know whether they're in Homer.
Yeah. Quiz!
Okay. He does all that very clever epithet stuff, and he goes off on these wonderful digressions, which are occasionally very funny, and there are, you know, the modernisms have things. My favourite one, which comes in book 16, is when he says Thestor, who is riding alongside Patroclus, and he says their chariots pass so close, the hub-skinned hub, and then Patroclus prized Thestor up and out as easily as later men detach a sardine from an open tin.
Yeah,
you think,
beautiful.
That's great, because previously we've had wolves, we've had sheep, we've had all sorts of totally credible, non-anachronistic metaphors and similes, but suddenly you get this, and it's playful, and he plays with Cape Kennedy, and he plays with all sorts of interesting things. Now,
so far this quiz is easy.
But what am I saying?
No helicopters either.
No helicopters.
Is the playful tone anywhere in Homer?
No, not really. Homeric grandeur is a thing, no, he's not. He's not very playful. I mean, there are things about him which are sort of beautiful and like small smile, kind of lovely. Like nature similes are a huge part of Homer. So you get, you know, men are compared, you know, routinely warriors are compared to animals, and particularly he doesn't have quite the same enthusiasm for insects that Virgil does, where everyone's always compared to ants or bees or something, you know, in a sort of adorable workerish way. But no, the idea of playfulness is not particularly. You'll get playfulness in later iterations when the tragedians take it on. Then you'll really see it. So the aftermath of the Trojan War, for example, includes the Nostoi, the journeys back from Troy to Greece, and one of the more famous, the most famous Nostos is the Odyssey, perhaps the other most famous is Agamemnon getting home in the Oresteia, in Aeschylus's Oresteia, and getting, spoiler, but in Euripides' telling of the Electra story, so the daughter of Agamemnon, who he has not sacrificed, who takes revenge on her mother, who has killed her father. When Aeschylus does that in the Oresteia, there's a recognition scene between Electra and Orestes, who has been absent for a long time, and it's a bit silly, but it's presented with sort of quasi-Homeric grandeur. Aeschylus famously described his work, apparently, as slices from the banquet of Homer. And then when Euripides takes it on, there's a sort of pastiche of that recognition scene where Electra sees a footprint and a lock of hair at Agamemnon's tomb in Aeschylus, and she says, I recognise this footprint, and I recognise that hair is just like mine. It's like it's just a disembodied lock of hair, but that's how she knows it's her brother. And when Euripides takes it on, she kind of this whole scene is presented as ridiculous, and it's like, well, obviously you wouldn't recognise somebody from a lock of hair. That would be just stupid. And it's like, are you throwing shade over? Right, okay. And that play was sort of 25 years old at that point, so you're asking people to have a long memory. So you do get this sort of playful interrogation of the Trojan War, but it isn't in Homer, in my opinion.
Just so that we can be, we're really interested just setting the Iliad in some kind of context. I mean, it's older than, it's the oldest telling of the Trojan story that we have.
Probably. Yes, probably.
And
it's
probably older than the Odyssey. And how was it performed? Just because I think that does have some bearing on what Loeb does with his voice.
I mean, that's a really good question and one that nobody can definitively answer. But it's performed presumably in chunks at a time. It doesn't seem very likely that somebody, you know, went to the trouble of learning all 24 books. But it's performed by a rhapsode.
Art of memory stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it would just be a really long time to listen to, right? If you've ever gone to an all-day Iliad, the Almeida did one a few years ago. German Street did an all-day Odyssey, I think, online during lockdown 2. Forgotten. But the all-day Iliad at the Almeida started at, I can't remember, nine, I guess, at the British Museum, and eventually moved to the Almeida, sort of with performances on the bus to get you there. And even they were having to cut as they went, because even allowing whatever that was, sort of 14 hours, they'd expected it to be enough to get through, and you can't. It's just too long.
And
even
instrumentation,
if you really go
a lick. Would they have used, would there have been...
Yeah, it's sung rather than rather than written, composed, I suppose. And it seems quite likely. I mean, we can... you can't conclude necessarily, but you can maybe guess from the way that Demodocus, the bard in the Odyssey, when Odysseus lands in Phaeacia, in book six, five, the very end of five, but they have a feast in book eight. I should know this. And this bard called Demodocus, who's blind, this is why people think Homer is blind, because right. the bard in the Odyssey sings about Achilles at Troy, and everyone assumes, therefore, not wholly unreasonably, that that's a reference to the Iliad, and that therefore this is like a little internal joke, either, you know, by the same poet, or more likely by another poet making the reference. So you perform at a banquet, everyone has... I mean, but did they all have meat and wine? And no one eats vegetables, no one eats fish anywhere in Homer, it's bananas. No one eats bananas either. but, you know, when they're stranded in Thrinacia in the Odyssey, in whatever book that is, they're sort of appalled by the idea they might have to eat fish. And they have this very heroic, Homeric, specific feasting culture of Bronze Age heroes. So you eat meat, which you've sacrificed, obviously, part of to the gods, and you drink wine. And then a bard delivers essentially a narrative performance. And that, we have to assume, that's why the epithets of Homer they're really, really difficult to translate for people now. And I think Loeb makes the very sensible choice of largely disregarding them.
And making his own.
Because what are you supposed to do? The act of repetition, if you're performing, it's a sort of circling background and a moment. You get it in performance poetry all the time. You get it in rap. But if you're reading it, it looks sort of weirdly unnecessary. And so I think that a lot of things about Homer which seem quite alien to us are because we're reading it, not hearing it. Yep. But when you hear it, it's a very different matter. And if you do ever get the chance to hear somebody perform a chunk of it, I really recommend it, because it's... You'd have to do the whole book if you don't want. You have to be a big nerd for that.
Loge would recite it when he was composing it, would go for long walks and sort of talk it through. So it's a very it's quite a musical poem, don't you think? War music, I mean, rather than the clues in the title, I guess.
But it's a very common thing with poets, he said in Ledbury. A lot of poets I have heard in interviews say that they walk the they walk the meter of the poem. And meter is really interesting, because when you're talking about Homeric grandeur, the Iliad that we have is written in dactylic hexameter.
It is.
Which is quite grand.
Who wrote that down?
And it, for that audience, would have been what they were familiar with. It was the classic form. What he does is play around with iambic pentameter, with alexandrines. He can change the most beautiful lines in this.
You're going to have to read some in a moment, by the way. We're taunting the audience with.
When I was talking about Achilles being humanized, there's a fantastic sequence where he hears for the first time that Patroclus has died. Now, we know Patroclus has died. He knows that Patroclus is going to die when he sends him out wearing his armour. And there's a whole riff about... That's the other lovely thing about these books. What happens with Achilles' armour is a very big deal. He sends Patroclus out in his armour, Patroclus dies. Hector wears his armour, thrilled to discover his armour, Hector dies. He's killed by Achilles. Achilles effectively kills himself twice. And then the second set of armour gets to Ajax, and Achilles' armour, however blessed and heaven-forged it is not...
It's cursed.
Yes, not a good thing. But there's another moment where he's sitting down, and in Loge's version, he talks to Odysseus, And just count out the syllables, because it's beautiful. He says, Patroclus was my life's sole love, the only living thing that called love out of me. Then there's a gap. Now, the sheer power of those eight syllables and another eight syllables and then the big stop. He ends the line on called and love out of me. Suddenly makes sense of that relationship in a really impactful way. And it's two lines. And he does that all the time. He plays with rhythms. My favourite in-battle sequence is when they are... There's a middle of a pitch battle. And this only works for a modern audience. This only works for an audience that has read Rupert Brooke. And he says, not one step back, but must. If I and does. The compression, the concision of that is just incredibly powerful. That very short couplet lasts about 2.5 pages in Fagles, who's the best of the poetic translators. I was going to ask you a question, and I've forgotten for the life of me what it was. It was about dactylic hexameter.
Yeah.
And
I was hoping you were going to ask me about the moment in the Iliad where Achilles finds out that Hector has died, because it is extraordinary.
Do you mean Patroclus?
Yes, sorry.
Yes. Natalie, tell us about the moment in the Iliad.
Because he falls to the ground.
Yeah.
And in that moment, and it's like, it's a moment where we come out of the internal and into a sort of, we become an omniscient person viewing it. We have the eyes of the poet in that moment. And he tells us that the man who's brought the news from the battlefield is worried that Achilles will just die of it, that he'll kill himself over this news, because he's so devastated to have lost Patroclus. And the idea of a man killing himself in grief for the loss of a comrade is, I mean, even in this poem, which is full of men losing comrades, is unusual. You know, it's an incredibly violent poem. I always find it...
And upsets his mother deep.
It does, yeah.
Calls her up from the bottom of the sea, his cry.
Yeah, of course.
What I was interested in, I don't know, because I have, as they say, no Greek, but parataxis, that idea of there's a lot of short, interchanging kind of sort of dialogue-y scenes in the Logue.
Yes.
I mean, is that kind of energy there in Homer?
I mean, you can't play as much in the same way, that because every line has to be six.
Yeah.
So there are moments when what you use in Greek are techniques which I guess we're probably more familiar with, perhaps now. But that's sort of, there are fewer tools maybe open to you, which is to use shorter vowel sounds and crisper consonants so that the line goes faster. You know, you can tell, it's easier to find in Latin actually. Ovid does it really well, Virgil does it really well, where you'll get a line which is full of U sounds and it's just like, everyone is grieving. And then you'll get a line that's full of very short, you know, crisp. But you can't change the meter. Epic is always so, it is always grand. That's how you know you're in grand territory. When Lucretius embarks on De Rerum Natura, he's staking his claim for it to be an epic poem about physics, because it's in hexameter. There you go.
On the walking thing, there's a brilliant anecdote in Logue's autobiography, which is very entertaining, called Prince Charming, where he says that Wordsworth trained his dog. Wordsworth used to compose as he walked, and he trained his dog to stop and bark if there was someone coming, so he would, because he didn't want people to think he was a lunatic. Just love that idea. Oh, how we love dogs.
That anyone should think a poet was a lunatic, really.
Are you going to read us a little?
I was just going to read you that part.
Do it.
Yeah, great.
But Logue's version of this is, down on your knees, Achilles, further down. Now forward on your hands and put your face into the dirt and scrub it to and fro. Grief has you by the hair with one, and with the forceps of its other hand uses your mouth to trowel the dog shit up. Watches you lift your arms to heaven, and then pounces and screws your nose into the filth. Gods have plucked drawstrings from your head, and from the template of your upper lip modelled their bows. Not now, not since your grieving reaches out and pistol whips that envied face until, frightened to bear your black, back-breaking agony alone, you sank, throat back, thrown back, your voice thrown out across the sea to reach your source. Now, it may not be great translation, but it's really good poetry.
Yeah. I mean, I think the question isn't about translation, it's about dialogue, isn't it? He's not translating Homer, he's in dialogue with Homer, as we all should be whenever we encounter him. It's like, if you're not asking questions and having them answered, then you're not reading him carefully enough, in my view.
When you were writing A Thousand Ships,
yes,
did you start from the principle of redress?
No, I started from the principle of thinking there was room for the other bit of the story. That was the nice thing about doing it. So it didn't feel like, I didn't feel like I'd got a grievance. I didn't feel like I had an axe to grind. I just felt, and still do feel, with Greek myth, that mostly these stories have loads of women in them, in ancient sources, and they just got lost in modern classicism, which for a really long time was the preserve of posh white men. And so what happens is, it's not that they don't like women, it's not that they're trying to exclude them, they just systematically go, oh, my wife wouldn't do this. And then those women have just suddenly been lost. And that's why you don't get a very reverent attitude, I think, to, you know, Helen is such an interesting duality in Homer, because the version that we get in the Iliad and the version that we get in the Odyssey are wildly different in terms of what their expectations of themselves are, if nothing else. And yet, you would search long and hard outside of, you know, hardcore academia to find any writer encountering that and discussing it until really recently. And so, honestly, I approached A Thousand Ships feeling like I'd won the lottery, that nobody had already done it. I couldn't believe it. I was like, are you kidding me? Can I have this? Is it mine? I couldn't believe it.
Helen, in Pandora's Jar, you say that one of the interesting things is that motivations of the male characters in the Iliad are pretty clear.
Yes.
I mean, you know, we kind of know why Achilles is upset about Patroclus dying. But the great conundrum at the heart of the Iliad is people going to war over a beautiful woman.
Yes.
And Helen's own motivations are much more subtle and complex.
They are. And she for sure stands in for Homer within the Iliad. She weaves a tapestry which tells the story of the Trojan War. So she is the visual representation of Homer. She's telling the story in terms of art you can look at, as Homer is telling you the story in terms of art you can hear. So she is him.
It's good.
Right? Let's just miss her out, men. She's only a lady.
How did you find Logue's presentation of the? There aren't we're not awash with women in the Iliad, are we?
No, it's not. I mean, Iliad.
Some gods, obviously, goddesses.
Yeah, the Iliad is. It's an extraordinary and beautiful poem, and it isn't particularly the place you would go to find representations of women, unless you were, like, on a desert island, and that there were not very many other stories available to you, because you just don't get very many of them. So we get Helen doing the Tachoscopia, as it's called, the looking down from the city walls in book three, which sort of gets elided in this to the scene in six with Andromache and Hector, which kind of cracks my heart slightly. It's like, we don't have many scenes, don't smash them into one. but that, I mean, that is obviously brilliant, because Priam asks Helen for her information about the Greeks who are on the battlefield. And he says, oh, you know, you're Greek, which one's that tall warrior, which one's that? He knows who they are. This is year 10 of the war. So they're telling us, you know, Helen is again being used as the mouthpiece of Homer at this point. So they're telling us who everyone is, so that we know. And then, of course, there's the scene with Andromache where she successfully predicts the entire end of her war. There's the moment in six where Hector sees his mother, sees Hecabe, and she talks to Theano, which means, as I always like to register, it does pass the Bechdel test, the Iliad, which isn't—it's not always guaranteed. So it's pleasing that it does. Two named women have a conversation about something other than a man. But yeah, I mean, the sort of most damning thing about it as a representation of women is that a talking horse gets nearly as many lines as Briseis. And I've always found that a bit of a struggle. But the nice thing horse. Is, so it's a really good horse. And I mean, it's magic, and it can talk, and it can see the future. It's got, to be fair to the horse, I don't blame the horse. But the thing is, not that you should therefore not read the Iliad because it doesn't have enough women in it, it's that you should read other stuff as well as the Iliad, because it doesn't
ideally,
have that
many women ideally, A Thousand Ships by Natalie.
Yeah, yeah.
Or the Odyssey would be fine.
Or indeed War Music by Christopher Logue.
Can I ask you just about the length of one's relationship, going back to your point about the length of the relationship with the Iliad. I've found, as I've got older, that my allegiances and sympathies have changed. Now, I am willing to bet that everyone who reads the Iliad picks it up as a book about Achilles, but the person, the man they care most about is likely to be Hector, who also gets the last line. You know, he is the most sympathetic character in the world, that none of this is his fault. He's had to carry the crown for his nightmare brother, as has Agamemnon. And what I'm fascinated by this, Logue is kinder to Agamemnon.
Everyone is kinder to Agamemnon than he was, but yes, you're right, he is.
And he also gives him, this ends with the agreement for Achilles to return to the fray. But he gives Agamemnon the most, in a strong field, the most incredible piece of oratory, where he basically spins them a brilliant... Actually, we're saying this today. I mean, we just ought to mark today as a day of...
The day when bad oratory died?
Yeah. But he gives Agamemnon this incredible speech where he not only plays the entire crowd, but he's sort of out Odysseus is Odysseus. And that's the other thing Logue's got.
Yes.
That he knows that Odysseus is actually the main player in this.
Yeah, yeah.
And he makes it very clear right from the beginning. And we are wise-assing with Odysseus all the way through this story, which I don't think we are necessarily in the Iliad.
Here's what I'm going to offer you as an alternative reading, and that is that the Iliad offers us, although you may not like it because of its lack of female characters, what it offers us is multiple templates of what it means to be a man. I think it is the most interesting engagement with masculinity that you could find, because every trope, every archetype that you could hope for. So I am not a fan of Agamemnon. I find him deeply petulant, and Iliad 1 is one of the most extraordinary... killing him in chips was the happiest day of writing it. I could have done it twice, happily. But, you know, he is the bad boss. He's petulant, he's angry, he's grabby. Achilles is incredibly, disproportionately angry, but a genius. And so, you know, and then there's Hector, the family man, but then there's Priam, the old patriarch. He's incredibly kind to Helen, not in a pervy way. He's just nice, you know, and we get that sense of him there. We have the cunning of Odysseus, which we're used to seeing as being a heroic thing. But if you read the Dolinea, the bit in 10 where he and Diomedes go on a night raid, they're terrifying. They're just terrifying in that. And so we have this, it's really difficult. But we have all these different versions of men, and there's this glorious moment in Iliad 3, where Helen's current husband and her first husband fight a duel, and neither of them can win. And it's like, oh, so neither of these men is essentially man enough in the, you know, dialogue of war to be victorious. In the end, Menelaus is slightly better, and Aphrodite simply rescues Paris because she likes him.
But what do we make of what Aphrodite does to Helen, both in the husbands and in Homer, what Aphrodite does to Helen back behind the wall when Paris... She
comes off the battlefield.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really difficult, but it makes Helen extremely hard to understand. And one of the things that makes particularly female characters in Homer very difficult to know is that we often find their behaviour has been influenced by a god. So I'll give you £100 if you can tell me 5 things Penelope likes by the end of reading the Odyssey. Because you can't, because routinely when she decides to do something, Athene has put the idea in her mind. Or Athene has sent her a dream of her sister. to tell her that she should do this or that or the other. And that's what happens with Helen and Aphrodite in the Iliad. So Helen says, you know, I don't really fancy Paris right now because he was a bit rubbish at fighting and I'm not hot for that guy. And Aphrodite says, go to him. That's a euphemism. if you don't, you know, you've always been my favourite, but you won't be. Yeah. And so this version of Helen is full of self-reproach. The version that we see in the Iliad is full of guilt for everything that she's caused. And yet, as far as we can see, she has no free will at all. If the goddess of desire tells you what to do, yeah, even Zeus won't mess with her because we all know how awful unrequited love is. Do you want that? You do not.
Do you think Logue does anything interesting with gods in the poem? Gods and goddesses?
Yes, I think he's... I mean, he has a lovely go with the epithets, which is my...
I think the god, using god instead of Zeus, is very interesting.
Yeah, it troubles me a little as a humanist, but yeah. I got through it. But I really like the way he tries to find a way through... Emily Wilson does it brilliantly in the Odyssey, in her translation of the Odyssey, of course, to find a way through those epithets so you don't omit them, but you find a way of saying, you know, Hera's got creamy skin because she's Hera of the white arms. And you're like, yeah, lovely. And, you know, cow-eyed Boopis is what she is in Greek, like me. And Athene, of course, is Glaucopis. She's owl-eyed, grey-eyed or blue-eyed. And so he finds ways of playing with that. So she has eyes like a lake. And it's like, well, that is probably more appropriate than eyes like a owl.
I mean, he is kind of brilliant on those epithets. I love it when he refers to Achilles at one point as Wondersulk, which is kind of what he is.
Yeah. I mean, he's swift-footed in the Greek, I guess. Yeah. That's the, yeah, you know, version that he's taken away. So there is something... Yeah, I mean, the kind
really
of Christianizing
of
gods
is confusing. Did you enjoy reading war music as a classical scholar and reteller of...
Always. Yeah. I mean, I'm always interested in the way people are in dialogue with ancient sources. And ancient sources are in dialogue with them too. It's not just Greek playwrights. It's Ovid taking on the stories, you know, when he does the Herodes, for example.
There's a thing that people write about war music, and they talk a lot about the cinematography of it.
Yeah.
And, you know, it starts off in books one and two, they get reverse the shot, go close, see Agamemnon, king of kings, Autarch of Argos, lord of both mainland and of island Greece. Bam! And you think, that's cool. My favourite one, which I just wanted to... I should read, because it just makes me laugh every time I... There's a thing Logue does with the sort of battle-boasting, bigging up of the translations of Homer that I have read, where you get these extended celebrations of whoever it is. And in this, and what's happening here is that Patroclus's body is in a bay, and Glaucus, who is Sarpedon's number two, is guarding the body while Hector's gone off to try and find the armour. And Odysseus and Ajax and little Ajax are moving their way up to the dunes to look down on it. And so he says, seabird's eye view. I love that. Again, this, what you were saying, suddenly you are lifted out.
Yes.
Soldiers around Patroclus, centaur ants hoisting a morsel, and on the whaleback's tidal side, Ajax and little Ajax, Helen's man, Odysseus and his driver Bombax, head a wedge of plate-faced Greeks. Now, close up on Bombax. 45, fighting since two, who wears his plate beneath his skin. One who has killed more talking bipeds than Troy's wall has bricks, whose hair is long, is oiled, is white, is sprung, plaited with silver wire, twice plaited. Strong? Why, he could swing a city to and fro with it and get no crick. Whose eye can fix a spider's web, yoking a tent peg to its guy, 5 miles down beach, and count its spokes.
Yeah, it's brilliant.
By night. Are you think?
Yeah, very good.
He's just doing this wonderful parody of the high grandeur. But what I wanted to ask you, which had suddenly slipped through all of that, was. a sense that all of this, although we're talking about female agency, all of this in Logue's world is manipulated by one person, and that's Hera.
Yes.
She is the one who's playing this.
She gets a lot of flack, in my view. In every source, all the time. It's always her fault. And there's a lovely meme that goes around periodically on social media that says that whatever it is, like a pie chart, it says something like 98% of problems in Greek myth would be resolved by Zeus keeping in his pants. And that is true. It's always Hera's vengeance, which is the issue. So here's what I'm going to argue in her defense, is that if you're Greek, she is a fiercely loyal defender of you. And her monstrous persecution of the Trojans is undeniable. But she's a Greek goddess. She should be on the Greek side, right? And so, yes, she is absolutely relentless. There's no suggestion, once you rouse her anger, that she can ever be assuaged. But who does that remind you of in this story? Achilles. She is closest to Achilles, in fact. She is like the representation of him. There is no quantity of blood she can drink that will make her feel sated. And that is him. You know, once his anger has been unleashed, at the moment that he becomes less petulant and more adult, the moment that he finds out that the man he loves is dead, there is nothing that will make it better until, you know, even when he's choking the river on corpses and the rivers are begging Hera and Hephaestus to make him stop, and instead they just torch the plains so that the river has to retreat. It's a terrifying, terrifying moment in the Iliad, and an extraordinary metaphor for the destruction of war, I think. And yet, the moment where we have any kind of resolution, even that is grudging, is when Priam is prepared to buy back his son's body from Achilles. And Achilles rejects him, remember. He rejects him, you know, as his first response. And eventually he's prepared to sell the body. But there is no sense that his anger has been diverted. It's just been paid for.
Yeah.
And that's who Hera is. That's why you make sacrifices to her. You're buying her, if not goodwill, then at least brief abatement of ill will in order to try. So, yeah, she is monstrous. It's true. At least in this regard. But I think the point that we have to all bear in mind is that the Trojan War is an attempt to... It's a too many human beings narrative. It's a really early too many human beings narrative. There are too many people. And so the gods create the Theban Wars, Oedipus and things, to make fewer of us. And that works for a bit, but then we keep, you know, breeding. And so the Trojan War happens because Gaia can't support our weight. So it's a population anxiety story, which means that we need her. We need her to persecute those poor Trojans because...
And that's the line you're running with. We need her to persecute. Okay.
Do you have a bit you want to read?
If you like.
Go on.
I do. So I'm going to give you the moment... Sorry, I always pick death. It's so typical of me. But there you are. I'm not going to tell you what it is. You'll work it out really fast. Hector, standing above you, putting his spear through, and saying, "Why tears, Patroclus? Did you hope to melt Troy down and make our women fetch the ingots home? I can imagine it, you and your marvellous Achilles, him with an upright finger saying, 'Don't show your face to me again, Patroclus, unless it's red with Hector's blood.' And Patroclus, shaking the voice out of his body, says, 'Big mouth, remember it took three of you to kill me, a god, a boy, and last and least, a prince. I can hear death pronounce my name, and yet somehow it sounds like Hector. And as I close my eyes, I see Achilles' face with death's voice coming out of it. Saying these things, Patroclus died, and as his soul went through the sand, Hector withdrew his spear and said, 'Perhaps.'"
Wow. We're running out of time.
But can I read mine?
Yeah, you can. I was just going to say, you can read and then we could go on all night, let's be honest.
But this is the bit which I think is an interpolation. But it's so beautiful, and it's so timely, as we sit here today on the 7th of July. Mark it well for fireworks and champagne.
If it's what you're reading,
And this is... Well, you'll know what it is. Ever since men began in time, time and time again, they met in parliaments where, in due turn, letting the next man speak, with mouthfuls of soft air, they tried to stop themselves from ravening their talking throats, hoping enunciated airs would fall with verisimilitude in different minds and bring some concord to those minds. Soft air between the hatred dying animals monotonously bear toward themselves. Only soft air to underwrite the inbuilt violence of being, to meld it to something more civil, rarer than true forgiveness. No work was lovelier in history, and nothing failed so often. Knowing this, the army came to hear Achilles say, "Pax Agamemnon," and Agamemnon's "Pax."
Brilliant. We haven't had time for questions. We haven't got onto many things. We didn't discuss the Vietnam War was raging through most of the 60s when this book was being, and a lot of people made the comparisons. We haven't got on to the to Logue's presentation of the of women characters in the poem, which isn't always as perhaps as good as the portrayal of male poems. There's a whole amount that we haven't done, but we have established, I think, that the Iliad is an immensely complex and brilliant poem, and that Logue's version of it is, I mean, I would say one of the most rewarding experiences I've had for a long time reading it. Really, I'm pleased. Can I just, on one thing though, Peter, I was really interested that you prefer the original 1981 slimmed down war music to the fatter later version.
I mean, I think it may be because I came across it first. I mean, I also, you know, prefer Art Garfunkel to Aretha Franklin's Bridge Over Troubled Water.
And what?
I know.
Get
which
out.
Is, which is just...
This ends now.
Well, it's just wrong. I know that. But it's what I found first. So, I mean, there's... This was a... Much as it was a very long project, it was also something that he revised all the time. And when I was corresponding with him in the 80s, he'd send me corrections on the first day, and the following day he'd say, no, actually, I've changed all that, and I've changed all this, and I want... And this wasn't a book that had already been published. And there were so many different revisions that he made, and he was also responsive to many different editors, not just Christopher Reed, who he worked with very intensely, but people at Farrar Straus, and...
Craig Raine.
He kept... appropriately, really. His relationship with Homer was ongoing and ever-developing. He would also find stuff that he just got wrong. Like, there was a great description of the way shields fold over, and he said, like Ashlar work when clinkered hulls, something. And then he discovered that he was completely wrong about Ashlar work. That isn't what Ashlar work is at all. So he changed it to something else. I mean, he was very responsive, constantly questioning, and he regarded it as a sort of... appropriately, a beyond life's work. It was never going to be finished, because Homer is never finished. And just as we, who don't have Greek, God, it's just going to be easier to learn it.
I would save you some time, that's all I'm saying.
You know, I can't wait for Emily Wilson's Odyssey, which is the most incredible translation. I mean, for her work, the translation of the word polytropos alone, I think, deserves, you know, standing ovation. Complicated is how she translated, but just...
Have I told you what happened when I met her? Okay. I did not come across as cool at all, you'll be unsurprised to hear. And I was late, you'll be unsurprised to hear. And we were doing an event at Cheltenham together. And I walked into the room and she was right there. And we've got friends in common we'd never met before. And I went, I like you so much, I should have your face on my T-shirt. And to be fair to her, she went, same. While backing out of the room. But she's so cool.
Well, her Iliad's coming out.
Next year, I think. Yes.
That would be fascinating to do.
I can't wait. Yeah. I just can't wait.
Revisit the Iliad in a year's time.
You can't have too many Iliads.
But that's the thing, isn't it? I get asked a lot about retelling of Greek myth and about retelling of Homer in particular, but Greek myth in general. And my answer doesn't really change because these stories are... They will wait for you for as long as it takes you to encounter them any way you want. And I don't mind if you come across Greek myth through Disney Hercules or through, you know, reading Homer in Greek.
Disney Hercules. It's brilliant. It's the best.
It is. I couldn't agree more. So it doesn't
matter. Better than Troy, let's be honest.
Oh, my God. They will wait for you forever. It's fine.
Can I just ask, because this was... I remembered why I wanted to do that Bombex bit. Yeah. Mm. Because... Everybody says, God, Logue's interpreted this cinematic effect. And you think, well, no, actually, Homer taught filmmakers how to move from close-up to epic.
And Virgil, even more so, actually.
Yeah. Because they're not just the foundation works of literature. They're the foundation, well, of vases for a start, but they're the foundation works of all
drama
and culture, aren't they?
Yeah, because we want to pull out and sometimes see the whole battlefield, and then we want to come in close. And that's why I think you get these brilliant exchanges between warriors. And I mean, some of them now ring quite strangely to us, and Logue very sensibly doesn't even really try and get on top of Ksenia, I think, that bizarre Greek society thing where friends and enemies and hosts and guests are all sort of interwoven, and you have to work out if you're actually an enemy of somebody by introducing yourself before you can fight, because it might be the case that your dad stayed with his dad, in which case you can't kill each other, you have to give each other presents. It's a strange war. But, you know, these things are all both incredibly familiar and incredibly alien, and it doesn't surprise me at all that you could spend decades revising an already... I mean, you know what writers are like. A book is never finished. They just take it off you and put it in a shop. So it's appropriate that you should still be arguing with past you and Homer and everyone in Homer all the time. That's how I fully intend to live and die.
Brilliant. Books are never finished. War is never finished. Governments sometimes are. There are books at the back, Christopher Logue's, and I think, Natalie, I'm sure you'll sign copies of your own.
I will.
Your own books. You can sign copies of Christopher Logue's if you
probably
want.
Probably won't, yeah.
Peter and I will simply be hanging around. I'm sorry we haven't had time for questions, but we had so much. I mean, it's a long poem.
It is. Listen, I'm a patron of Ledbury Poetry Festival, and on the behalf of Ledbury Poetry Festival, I need to thank you, John, with this very beautiful locally made brooch, appropriately.
Thank
you.
I love it.
And to thank you both for an amazing hour, which, you're right, could have gone on for days.
Yeah.
God bless the Almeida.
Thank you.